Lots and lots of CPUs have floating point multipliers, very fast compared to the typical integer multipliers. And the reason for that is the market for CPUs. Big CPUs are aimed at people who are, for example, running nuclear weapons simulations, or who are running weather simulations, or who are, let me take what's probably the biggest example of a computation that needs approximate real number arithmetic, people who are running simulations of a guy with a gun and a chainsaw running through some sort of dungeon and shooting and slashing at monsters. And while this sort of physics simulation, however realistic or unrealistic it might be, is the primary application of computers. And, well, if you're designing a CPU that you want to sell to people for use in their desktop computer, then they're going to buy it based on its performance on those applications. What do those applications do? How do you simulate physics in the computer? Well, you figure out where your objects are in space and time, and that's using approximate real number arithmetic. So your CPUs are naturally going to be designed to have a circuit built in to do those operations quickly. It makes perfect sense that Intel and Sun and every other manufacturer of a big CPU, every other manufacturer of a big CPU has put in a big floating point multiplier, because that's what the market, physics simulations, video games, that's what the market actually wants. All right, I wanted to jump into Pauli 1305. I'm not sure whether I answered all the questions from last time about the basic latencies and throughputs and so on of operations on the UltraSpark, so I'm happy to pause and address any questions that people might have. But I seem to have answered everybody's questions. Good. So at this point, we have a definition, at least a partial definition. I've given you the important features and told you where to look up the less important features. We have a definition of the number of UltraSpark cycles taken by a computation. A computation, a program, an algorithm, is a sequence of instructions. And how long does it take? Well, there's some fairly complicated but still tolerable notion of what it means. We also have a particular function that we want to compute, namely Pauli 1305. So let's put these together and start looking at Pauli 1305 under this cost measure, Pauli 1305 on the UltraSpark. What do I have to say about this? Well, I want to tell you the speeds achieved by existing software, but let me try to formulate the general question first. Whenever you have some computation like Pauli 1305, or, well, any cryptographic function, then you have to figure out, if you want to make it run quickly, you have to figure out how to break that computation down into the instructions that are available to you. And there are, of course, infinitely many ways to do that, but you want to find a good one. How do you break, in the case of Pauli 1305 and RSA and lots of other interesting functions, you have big integer computations, big integer arithmetic. How do you partition that into UltraSpark instructions? Or whatever CPU you're facing, whatever platform you're facing, how do you use its instructions to do big integer arithmetic? As a reminder, what is Pauli 1305, since it's been so long since we've seen it, what is Pauli 1305 doing? Well, it's evaluating a polynomial in one variable, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, moderately large prime. Pauli 1305 computes a first 128-bit, 129-bit chunk of a message, which was called C sub 1, that gets multiplied by some secret R, which is provided as input to Pauli 1305. Then the next chunk of the message, C2, is added to that, and the result multiplied by R. And then you add another chunk and multiply by R again, and keep going in this way. After final multiplication by R, reduce the result mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. This is not quite the end of the computation. Remember that after evaluating the polynomial at R, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, getting a result between 0 and 2 to the 130 minus 6, you have to add S, And then the official version of Pauli 1305 was adding S mod 2 to the 128. Takes this integer now between 0 and 2 to the 130 minus 6, adds S not mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, adds it mod 2 to the 128, takes the bottom 128 bits of the result. So clearly the big operations we're doing here, aside from that last little addition, mod 2 to the 128, which sounds very easy, the big operations are those multiplications, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. If 130 were much smaller, then you could imagine doing these operations somehow inside registers, R would fit into a register, but it doesn't. So that's a starting problem that makes this computation a little tricky to map onto the CPU, is that these numbers, a 130-bit integer, like R, actually R was restricted a bit, so it's a little smaller than 130 bits, but all the intermediate numbers you see in here are random-looking, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, random 130-bit integers, even numbers that are a little smaller, like R, don't fit into the registers on the UltraSpark or any other CPU that anybody actually has. Well, let's look at what some actual software, the current state-of-the-art message authentication software, does on the Spark. And the same software, different implementations of Pauli 1305 for different CPUs. Let me just talk about the speed and then the details of the Spark software for Pauli 1305. What does this do? Well, let's break down the speed into, I'm going to ignore the final addition of S, and just think about the repeated operation here of adding a chunk of the message and multiplying by R. For this software, the main loop, one loop is add a chunk of the message, multiplied by R, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. So this is doing an addition and, more importantly, a multiplication by R, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. This main loop takes a surprisingly small number of UltraSpark cycles, namely 69 UltraSpark 3 cycles. You can also look at the same software on other Sparks. There are lots of different machines that will all follow the same instructions, the Spark instruction set, which I was showing you, and they will have maybe slightly different speeds, but this software gives you essentially the same speed on, say, the UltraSpark 2, 68 UltraSpark 2 cycles. Inside this main loop, this is for handling 16 bytes of a message. Inside this main loop, you would imagine lots of integer operations going on to somehow work with chunks of these numbers, modulo 2 to the 130 minus 5, but in fact, this record is set with floating point operations. There are, inside the main loop, there are, as I recall, 40 integer instructions, which doesn't sound like very many, and it's not very many. That would only take 20 cycles if they're well parallelized. There's one branch, one go-to, at the end of the loop saying if we have another 16 bytes of the message, go back to the top, and then if there's between 1 and 15, do something else. What is next? There are some loads and stores, which, as I recall, totaled 4 stores. Normally, if you're doing a computation, then inside the main loop, you try to keep everything inside registers if possible, but inside Pauli 1305, taking a chunk of the message, it's convenient to kind of pick it up and then put it back into memory in order to move it to floating point, which is what's coming up next. I see the computer's getting creative color-wise here. Let me put back the boring Ubuntu screen. There are 4 stores for moving data from integer to floating point. There are 36 loads. That starts sounding like a serious bottleneck. Remember the load store unit. There's one load store unit on the UltraSpark, which can do each cycle a load or a store. That means that unit's taking 40 cycles, pretty big chunk of the 68, for just doing loads and stores, mostly loads. There are a bunch of floating point multiplications, 34 floating point multiplications. And then finally, the clear bottleneck in this list of instructions is the floating point additions, which are exactly 68 floating point additions. The UltraSpark 3, also the UltraSpark 2, you'll recall, has one floating point adder unit. When I say additions here, I'm counting subtractions as additions. The floating point adder unit can do one addition or subtraction each cycle. So it's busy for 68 cycles of the main loop doing floating point additions, and the total number of cycles for the main loop is 69 on the UltraSpark 3, which means there's not much room for improvement unless you somehow reduce the number of floating point additions. Obviously, this computation is being dominated by the floating point. The integer execution units actually have some spare capacity, which might be useful here, but it's going unused. Maybe there's a way to save time using the integer execution units, but nobody's been able to do better so far. What's going on inside of this? Why are floating point numbers used? Well, as we were discussing before, floating point is what the chip manufacturers provide for the market. So if you make your cryptographic operations look like floating point operations, then you're taking advantage of how chips are actually designed, and this is what this software actually does. The critical idea here is to break each number. This is, well, kind of obvious, the general idea of breaking each number into a sum of floating point numbers. The details are what dictate the exact speed here. I'm going to write R, let me be careful with my subscript. I'm going to write R as a sum of four floating point numbers, which I'll label in a way that'll make sense in a moment. R sub 0 plus R sub 34 plus R sub 66 plus R sub 98. And what are those R sub I's? Well, the general rule I'm going to have for subscripts here is that anything sub I is going to be a multiple of 2 to the I, small integer times 2 to the I. Specifically, R sub 0 is going to be a multiple of 2 to the 0. It's an integer. And the range of that integer is, let me see if I get it right, I believe that remembering the definition of R, that integer is between 0 and 2 to the 28 minus 1. Remember that before I was saying R poly 1305 4 speed, and here's an example of that, although this is not the important class of CPUs I was referring to, 4 speed, R looks like a number between 0 and 2 to the 28 minus 1, that's exactly this R is 0. Plus 2 to the 32 times something, which I'll get to in a moment. R sub 34 is a multiple of 2 to the 34, which sounds like, wait a minute, can we actually write R this way? Maybe this is too restrictive, having R 34 be a multiple of 2 to the 34. But remember that R had a 2 to the 32 times something, where the something was required to be a multiple of 4. Well, this is just restating the definition that I gave some time ago. 2 to the minus 34 times R34 is an integer by construction of R, and in fact a small integer. 2 to the minus 66 times R66 is a small integer, and 2 to the minus 98 times R sub 98. These are all small integers, where what's the range of small? Well, the way I stated R before was the 32-bit chunks of it were between 0 and 2 to the 28 minus 1 and multiples of 4. If I divide out the 4s, as I've done here, I get integers between 0 and 2 to the 26 minus 1. And now these chunks, R sub 0, R sub 34, R sub 66, R sub 98, normally if you're expanding an integer in some radix, like radix 2 to the 32, you would say small integer plus 2 to the 32 times some small integer plus 2 to the 64 times some small integer. But I'm integrating those powers of 2 into the r's, which is quite convenient in floating point arithmetic. The software, all this is stuff the software does, the software writes r as blah, 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 and puts these pieces of r, r0, r34, r66, and r98 into floating point registers. All right. There's also, of course, a number being multiplied by r, which I have the clever notation x for. In retrospect, maybe that's not the best since I was using x before, but I don't think I've got any other x's today, so let me stick to the x in my notes. Intermediate results that are going to be multiplied by r and also adding a chunk of the message to these. Intermediate results x are, well, here they're not as restricted as the secret key r was. These intermediate results look kind of random, but we'll still be able to write them in rate x2 to the 32, x0 plus x32 plus x64 plus x96. And now these x's are, I'm going to say, without being totally precise about the ranges, that x sub I is a multiple of 2 to the I, where the multiple is small. If you take 2 to the minus I times x sub I, then it is a small integer. As the computation goes on, the notion of small kind of grows and shrinks again. And one reason that it grows is that if you want to add 128 bits to this intermediate result, you can simply add 4 byte chunks to each of the x's. Adding a message chunk, a 16-byte chunk of the message converted into a 129-bit integer, adding that to this x, once the message chunk itself has been expressed in a similar form, boils down to simply doing 4 additions. Adding a message chunk is simply 4 floating point additions. Obviously, however big an x was before the floating point addition, when you add a chunk into it, it gets a little bit bigger. And that's the sort of thing where if you want to go through carefully figuring out how big all the x's are, then you have to pay attention to before the operation it was a little smaller, after it's a little bigger, and then stuff I'm going to talk about in a few minutes will make subsequent results smaller again. In any case, the addition of a message chunk fits into a floating point and boils down to 4 floating point additions plus building a message chunk. I haven't said how IEEE 754 works, but believe me when I say that the easiest way to take an integer out of memory and put it into a floating point number involves doing 4 more, well, for one number, 1 more floating point addition. Doing that for 4 32-bit numbers in the easiest way by far involves 4 more floating point additions. It's possible that other ways of doing this without using floating point additions, using integer operations to handle what IEEE 754 specifies, could be fast enough to eliminate these 4 floating point additions profitably, but the current software, which is the best we have, but there's lots of possibilities for improvement, the current software does 4 more floating point additions to convert the message chunk to floating point. All right, having added a message chunk to x, you then multiply the result, which I'll again call x, multiply the result by r. Now we can multiply, we can compute r times x mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. X is a sum of small numbers, small in terms of if you ignore the power of 2, then each of the chunks of x has just a few bits in it. multiplying those chunks by the chunks of R, you get an expression for, certainly the following statement is true, that R times X is R0 times X0 plus a bunch of other cross products. R times X equals, I'm going to partition the terms here according to their size, that R0, X0 is kind of small. That's a small multiple of 2 to the 0. And then you add to that R0, X32 plus R34, X0, both of which are pretty small multiples of 2 to the 32. And then you add R sub 0, X64, and you get more and more terms every level of this picture, R34, X32, and R66, X sub 64, 32, and 0. That sounds like a good pattern. These are each small multiples of 2 to the 64. For instance, R34 is a small multiple of 2 to the 34, and therefore an almost a small multiple of 2 to the 32, times a 2 to the 32 multiple is a multiple of 2 to the 64. And same for these others. They're all multiples of 2 to the 64, and adding them together is a slightly larger multiple of 2 to the 64. And then there's one most complicated term before they start shrinking again, R0 X96 plus R34 X sub 64, R sub 66 X sub 32 plus R sub 98. Was that the last one? Yes, times X sub 0. There's a reason I'm writing all these subscripts here, and that'll be clear from the next number that I write down. I claim that everything after this is a multiple of 2 to the 130, which you've heard of before as being approximately the prime. If I take, what's the next term here? If I collect the multiples of 2 to the, what would be the next thing? 2 to the 128. In fact, everything here is a multiple of 2 to the 130 because I have R34 times X96. Just adding 34 to 96, you get 130. This is a multiple of 2 to the 130. And then R sub 66 times X sub 64, again the sum there is 130. And then R sub 98 times X sub 32, sum of 130. And the remaining terms are even larger multiples of 2 to the 130. For instance, R sub 66, I'm almost done here, X sub 96, and R sub 98 times X sub 64. And the very last term is R sub 98 times X sub 96, which of course is a multiple of 2 to the something gigantic. All right, let me emphasize, because I'm going to be exploiting this to reduce mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, these last three chunks of the sum, pretty large portion of the product, except for the four numbers that we're adding up here, the remaining numbers are all multiples of 2 to the 130. These are in 2 to the 130z. And that tells us a much smaller number than Rx. Rx is something like 2 to the 256-ish. There's a much smaller number than Rx, which is congruent to Rx mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. Rx is congruent to, let me give names to the pieces here with a reduction, Y0 plus Y32 plus Y64 plus Y96, something that has the same shape, the same representation as X, and it's suitable as a next X, although I won't call that one X because that would be confusing with the input. Rx is congruent to the sum of the four Ys, and I'm about to write down by reducing this in a very obvious way, modulo 2 to the 130 minus 5. And what are the y's? Well, y sub 0 is r0 x0 plus a 2 to the 5 times, blah, 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 start over, 2 to the minus 130 times 5 times all of the stuff in parentheses on the fifth line of the previous product. That is 5 times 2 to the minus 130 times r34 times x96 plus two more terms that look the same, 5 times 2 to the minus 130 times R sub 66 times X sub 64, and then finally 5 times 2 to the minus 130 times R sub 98 X sub 32. and then y sub 32 is defined in a similar way, and I'll just start it off and then trust you to finish off the pattern. R0 x32 plus R34 x0, and y64 is something similar, y96 is something similar. There's also a 5 times 2 to the minus 130, dot, 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 showing up in y32 and y64 and in y96. Each of these, I've taken the original 16 products and added them into these four y's with some extra 5 times 2 to the minus 130s. And 5 times 2 to the minus 130 is just another floating point number, which we can pre-multiply by the r's. This looks really good. This looks like a way to compute, starting from x, written as a sum of four numbers. If you want to multiply it by r, mod 2 to the 130, 2 to the 130 minus 5, then here I've written the product as a sum of four numbers, which are pretty quickly computed in floating point. And which can then be used for subsequent additions and multiplications. There's some problems, and I'll go through the problems carefully. It looks like, let's see, there are 16 products here, 16 multiplications, assuming that the 5 times 2 to the minus 130 times R66 is stored in advance, using numbers that you can just pre-compute, pre-computed 5 times 2 to the minus 130, etc. 5 times 2 to the minus 130 times these r's, like r34, etc. And then we also have 12 additions to add the 16 products into four numbers. But this strategy has three problems. It runs into size issues with the y's. And there are three reasons that the y's are too big. Which I want to go through carefully. And that's what accounts for spending quite a bit more time, quite a few more floating point operations, instead of 16. How much do we have so far? We have 16 multiplications, 12 additions, but then 8 more additions, so 20 additions, instead of the 68 additions that I said are actually being taken. The general principle, though, aside from the size problems, the software does this computation. It says we're going to multiply the each chunk of the r. R is a sum of these pieces, r0, r34, etc. Each chunk gets multiplied by each chunk of the x's, which, if you scale this up, that quadratic time, the squarish kind of picture is not the best way to multiply. But for small sizes, it's just fine. It's about the best we know how to do. And then we add up the results, giving a y0 plus, etc., which looks like x, and is suitable for further computation. All right, what are the size problems? I guess this is the middle board, so I'll start on this one. The first problem is, if you look at the total y0 plus y32 plus y64 plus y96, then you easily see that's not guaranteed, not even close to guaranteed, to be between 0 and 2 to the 130 minus 6. So this is issue number one. There is no guarantee. That the sum is in the right range, least remainder mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. No guarantee that y0 plus y32 plus y64 plus y96 is between 0 and p minus 1, 2 to the 130 minus 6. When I took the bottom part of this picture, and as I'm sure you've all checked by now, wrote down a result that's congruent mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. The difference is clearly 2 to the 130 minus 5 times an integer. You can write down the integer if you like. All the 2 to the minus 130s get absorbed into pieces of that integer, thanks to everything I've written down being multiples of 2 to the 130. Anyway, these numbers, which are congruent to the original result, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, and certainly look a lot smaller. We don't have these numbers like 2 to the 200 or so anymore. This is all much smaller. It's still not minimal. It's not the least remainder of r times x mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. We have somewhat reduced the product, Rx, but almost never to its least remainder, its smallest remainder, unless you get really lucky. Fortunately, this is not a problem. It's not even close to a problem, because the idea that you have to have at each step of the computation the result mod 2 to the 130 minus 5 is not at all true. If you were off by some multiple of 2 to the 130 minus 5 in the middle of the computation, you then go ahead with additions and more multiplications and additions and more multiplications, which just give you something that's off by another multiple of 2 to the 130 minus 5. And that's fine as long as you clean it up at the end of the computation. This is not a problem. You do not need the smallest remainders. The reason that people reduce numbers in the middle of a computation is to make sure that the numbers don't grow ridiculously large. If you were to not reduce at all and just take C1 times R and add C2 and multiply by R again and add C3 and multiply by R again, every time you multiply by R with no reduction at all, your numbers would get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger linearly with the number of multiplications. And by doing some reduction in each step, you guarantee that that does not happen. The reason that people reduce intermediate results is not because the final function is defined mod p. It's so that they speed up the intermediate computations. We reduce intermediate results to save time, not because you want some mod p at the end. Not for minimality. If minimality does save time, then okay, sure. But if it doesn't, if you just want partial reduction, some people say lazy reduction, then that's just fine. This is one of the most important ways to speed up integer and polynomial arithmetic. Of course, you do, at the end of your computation, have to clean up. Clean up mod 2 to the 130 minus 5 at the end of the computation. But that happens only once. I haven't said anything about the speed of this function for short messages. If you look at it for, say, a 0-byte message or a 1-byte message, it ends up taking something pretty big chunk of 1,000 cycles, something like 700 pops into my head. So it's actually a noticeable delay to look at a small message, and you don't want to pump that number up arbitrarily. But typically messages are longer, and the 68 cycles or 69 cycles for handling every new 16 bytes of the message is more of an issue than what you do at the end of the computation. Of course, when you're doing benchmarks, you should measure all of these things. All right, so that's issue number one. But there's two other reasons that the Y's are too big. And issue number two is a serious problem. And then issue number three is even more serious. Issue number two is, if we look at these y's, like y96, which is just the same as the parenthesized term here, then we've multiplied these r's, which are each 20-something bits, times these x's, which are however many bits, and then that's clearly bigger than the x's were. It's clearly not possible to use this y again. I said the y has the right form to be multiplied by r again. It's looking just like x. But actually, each individual piece of it is big, considerably bigger than the pieces of the x's. If there are, say, 25 bits in the x's and 25 bits in the r's, and there are 50 bits in the y's, and if you do another multiplication, you're in trouble. It's clearly not possible to multiply this y by r without changing the representation. The y sub i's are much bigger, they have many more bits, than the x sub i's. Bigger by however big each r sub i was, about 26 bits, 28 or 26 bits bigger. this is a problem. You really do need to feed y to another multiplication, and if that doesn't fit into floating point, then I should mention this is it's not possible to multiply y by r in floating point, because the y's are just at the edge of floating point, and, well, if you tried multiplying again, you obviously go past what a floating point number can handle. So we have to clean this up. This is a problem. The solution is carries. Which, like any other form of reduction, are something that you do to save time in your subsequent computation. It's not something that you have to religiously do according to any particular notion of carries. But let me give a fairly extreme form of a carry, which turns out to be about the fastest thing that anybody knows how to do. If somebody says, carry from y sub 0 to y sub 32, let's suppose y0 is 2 to the 0 times a 50-bit number, and y32 is 2 to the 32 times a 50-bit number. What does this mean, to carry from y0 to y32? It means to take the closest multiple of 2 to the 32 out of y0 and put it into y32. Subtract from y0 and add to y32 a single number, which obviously won't change the sum since we subtracted it and added it. It won't change the sum of y0, y32, y64, and y96. And what do we subtract and add? The closest multiple of 2 to the 32 to y0. This is something that's easy to compute. We can take this nearest multiple. Even though I haven't described a nearest multiple instruction, if you think back to the examples I was giving of the UltraSpark instructions, then you realize, actually, I did give a nearest multiple instruction, which was the floating point addition. Wait a minute, how is addition rounding to a nearest multiple? Ah, addition is rounding. Floating point operations are not exact. Exploit the fact that floating point numbers are, when you operate on them, rounded. You don't get every floating point result exactly. In some ways, this is a problem. It means we can't write down numbers that are too big inside floating point registers, but it also means we can take advantage of the floating point operations in order to do something number theoretically useful, like rounding to a nearby multiple. Suppose that we take the following number, I'm going to define this as alpha sub 32, 2 to the 32 times 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51. Inside parentheses, 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51. And then I multiply by 2 to the 32. If in floating point you say, let's add alpha 32 to something, in particular this y0, then what do you get? This is rounded to the nearest floating point number. And then from the result, if you subtract off alpha 32 again, I claim that what you get is exactly the closest multiple of 2 to the 32 to y0. You obtain the multiple, integer multiple, of 2 to the 32 closest to y0. Because of that particular choice of alpha 32, if you think about what are the floating point numbers near alpha 32, suppose y0 were, say, 1, and you added 1 to this number. This is a big number, 2 to the 84 plus something. And then plus 1, that certainly doesn't sound like a floating point number. In fact, the next floating point number above 2 to the 84 would be 2 to the 84 plus, 2 to the 32. And that same 2 to the 32 shows up no matter what y0 is. If you take a floating point number y0 and add this alpha 32 and subtract it off again, you will get the closest multiple of 2 to the 32. So that means that if you take y0 minus that result, then it is an integer at most 2 to the 31. And then you can add the same result to y32. I mean, replace y0 by y0 minus this multiple and replace y32 by y32 plus the multiple. And that suddenly makes y0 minus this result. The new y0 turns into a very small number between minus 2 to the 31 and 2 to the 31, which is obviously the smallest you could expect. The bound of 2 to the 31 plus or minus is the smallest you could imagine for one of these numbers where you have everything else in the number has to be a multiple of 2 to the 32. How much time did this rounded addition, subtraction, another subtraction, and an addition take? Well, that's 4 floating point additions. 4 floating point adds for each carry. And we need to do 4 carries from y0 to y32, 32 to 64 to 96, and then 96 back to 0 involves an extra multiplication by 5 times 2 to the minus 130. Total is 16 floating point additions for these 4 carries plus 1 floating point multiplication for the y96 to y0, where again, when you carry out a y96, you get a multiple of 2 to the 130, which you multiply by 5 times 2 to the minus 130 to get something you should add to y0 instead of a non-existent y sub 130. All right, the total operation count so far is, instead of the 20 additions and 16 multiplications I mentioned before, we've got an extra multiplication, 17 multiplications, and now 36 floating point additions, which also sounds quite good. It's still quite a lot smaller than what I said the actual performance of this software is. So there's one more issue. Which I'm sure some of you have already spotted, that in fact, y's themselves don't fit into floating point numbers. If you calculate how big the x's are, how big the r's are, and then multiply them together, you realize, oops, that doesn't fit, especially if you add a bunch of them up. But I think even the individual products don't fit into a floating point number. They're close. It sounded good. We have these 64-bit floating point registers, and the r's have been shrunk a little bit, and then the x's are only half of 64 bits, so maybe it all fits, but no, it doesn't. So this is issue number 3, and what causes the biggest slowdown is that not just the y's times the r's again, but the y's themselves don't fit into floating point. The y's sub i's are too big, they'll be rounded. According to the usual double precision floating point rules. This means that the computation of y is not a simple series of floating point operations. If you want to compute this exact integer, then you have to do something more complicated. If you just do the 4 multiplications and 3 additions, then you will get something rounded. It's pretty close to fitting. If somehow magically your floating point numbers had, instead of 53 bits, if they had 64 bits, then everything would be just fine. Even a little less than 64 bits, you'd be just fine. But 53 bits is not enough room for the y sub i's. If you work out carefully bounds on the y sub i's, then you see 53 is not enough. And the only solution is to increase the number of pieces. Instead of chopping numbers into 4 pieces, chop them into more. There's several strategies for doing this. You could try chopping numbers into, say, 6 pieces, or maybe chop them into 5 pieces. I haven't been able to get that to work, but I also can't convince myself that it can't work. 6 definitely can be made to work, but almost as efficient in terms of any theoretical complexity measure, and certainly much easier to get working, is to just split r into twice as many pieces. The general solution is to split your integers into more floating point numbers. And you should choose how many floating point numbers you have. Choose your radix like this, 2 to the 32, implicitly running around everywhere. It's not something inherent in the original problem. It's something that the software chose in order to try to run as quickly as possible, and then revise the choice by splitting it to sums of more floating point numbers, more FP registers. In particular, this software splits R into 8 pieces. Which means that instead of the 4 pieces before, there's twice as many R pieces that have to be multiplied by the X's. There's twice as many multiplications here all of a sudden, and there's another multiplication sneaking in somewhere. There's almost twice as many additions. This basically doubles the number of operations. If you imagined instead doing some more balanced splitting of instead of 4 and 8, moving to 6 and 6, then, well, 36 versus 32 is kind of similar, maybe even worse for the 6 times 6, but, well, okay, this is the best that I've found so far, is splitting R into 8 pieces, and this ends up with the 68 floating point additions and 34 floating point multiplications that I mentioned before. In other words, in terms of the number of bytes of the message, the performance here is dividing by 16 bytes that were handled here for one 128-bit chunk of the message. This is something like 4.3 cycles per message byte. Which, as you look at more and more performance numbers, you get some feeling for how that compares to other speeds out there. All right, that was all I wanted to say about the Poly 1305 UltraSpark complexity. I have some notions of eventually showing people the Poly 1305 software and some cool pictures regarding the data flow that made the latency here not be at all a problem. And I think my notes have a little bit of commentary on how to do that, which is coming up later. But what I mainly want to do for the rest of today, I don't have the pictures drawn yet, what I want to do for the rest of today is have one blackboard full of comments on the Pentiums, since I think a lot more people have those based on hands raised the other day, yesterday. A lot more people have Pentiums than UltraSparks, and you surely want to know whether any of these notions of how to do arithmetic have any relevance to, say, a Pentium 4 is maybe your desktop computer. And I want to show you the software environment that I recommend, the Chasm tools for writing fast software, high-speed cryptographic software, or other high-speed software. But before I jump into the Pentium, are there any questions about what's going on with the Poly 1305 computation, how we break down big 130-bit integer multiplications into a lot of little floating-point operations? Yeah? Okay, so the question was, where do these y's come from? I guess, why is this sum of the y's congruent to r times x modulo 2 to the 130 minus 5? Am I understanding the question correctly? Well, in some sense, okay, first of all, I've defined some y sub i's, so I don't have to prove anything at that point. I then claim that the sum of the y's is congruent to r times x modulo 2 to the 130 minus 5, that the difference is 2 to the 130 minus 5 times an integer. And the proof is simply subtract big mess from big mess, having added up all the y's. You subtract that from what you see in r times x, and you realize there's a whole bunch of cancellation, and then the only things happening differently are, for instance, rx has an r sub 0 x sub 96 in it, where, actually that one cancels too, Rx has an R sub 34 X sub 96 in it, whereas the Y sub 0 has the same thing times 5 times 2 to the minus 130. And what's the difference between those? It's exactly 1 minus 5 times 2 to the minus 130 times R34 times X96. And remember that R34 X96 is a multiple of 2 to the 130. which means that one, maybe I'll just write the little crucial little formula down at the bottom here. If you have 1 minus 5 times 2 to the minus 130, and then multiply that by a multiple of 2 to the 130, 2 to the 130j, say, then cleverly multiplying 2 to the 130 times the thing on the left, you see this is exactly our favorite prime, 2 to the 130 minus 5 times an integer. And the same for all the other terms that we have. The difference between Rx and the sum of the y's is some integer times 2 to the 130 minus 5. So we have the right answer, mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, which, assuming we do a little more work at the end to make sure we have the least remainder, then it's fine to have any intermediate results congruent mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. As long as we're just doing ring operations, additions, subtractions, multiplications, then we're fine not having least remainders in the middle of the computation. And then the rest of the analysis here, the issues 1, 2, and 3, were whether the y's are small enough to proceed with the computation. And the answer is, after enough modification, they are small enough. Did I answer the question? Okay. Are there more questions about writing numbers as sums of floating point, doing this kind of modular multiplication, or roughly where the performance figures come from? Of course, without looking at the details of the code, I don't expect you to have verified numbers like the 68 additions and said, oh yes, that is everything that's going on here, or the 69 cycles, but at least you should have some idea of where the numbers are coming from. The number of cycles there is measurement. So if I log into that same UltraSpark 3 or an older UltraSpark 2 that I have sitting around, a 296 megahertz UltraSpark 2, which actually has 4 processors, and it's from about 10 years ago, and it seemed like a fast machine at the time. Anyway, when I log into those machines and use that CPU cycles function that I briefly showed people yesterday, then the CPU cycles function reports the machine is doing, for instance, 1,000 iterations of the main loop in 68,000 cycles on the UltraSpark 2. The first loop, the first chunk of the message takes longer to get warmed up, and the last chunk takes longer, but if you pump up the message by 1,000 or 100 extra 16-byte blocks, then the UltraSpark ends up taking 68 or 69 times that number of blocks extra cycles. So these are our measurements, which you could also, if you look at the instructions, the sequence of instructions in the software, then you can see, okay, according to the manuals, it should be like this. But I have to say at this point, I don't know why it's more UltraSpark 3 cycles than UltraSpark 2 cycles. And for those of you who justifiably consider that 69 to be much, much more than the 68, if you can save one cycle, then you can probably save two, and you can probably save three. Well, not in this case, but as a general principle, if you can save a little bit, then by repeating, you can save a lot. And so understanding what's going on in that 69, I feel embarrassed that for about a year now, I've had that 69 and no explanation of why it's 69 instead of 68. According to everything I can figure out from the manuals, it should be 68 on both of those processors. Just the only bottleneck I can see is the number of floating point additions, but there must be something else going on, some part of the manual I've missed, or, God forbid, some undocumented feature of the UltraSpark. I hate it when people give you definitions and leave out essential details, but, well. Somehow, the UltraSpark 3 is taking a little more time than I can expect. To answer the question, the 69 and 68 were measurements. More questions about Pauli 1305 on the UltraSpark? Alrighty, let's talk about some real computers. What did I have listed here? Yes. The longest line of popular Intel computers was starting with the Pentium Pro, which is, of course, dead at this point. The 2 and 3 lasted for years, and the M is a refinement of this series. I'm leaving the Pentium 4 out of this list. It is another chip that has the same instruction set, follows the same instructions as these Pentiums, but it has very different timings. You have to rethink everything about your timings to understand the Pentium 4. But the Pentium M, say, until recently Intel's favorite laptop chip. The Pentium M is an example here of what I'm going to say about the performance of Poly 1305. Question? The cores are more like the M's than like the 4s, but so Intel, all of Intel's low power type chips have been a lot more like the Pentium Pro 2, 3 line than like the Pentium 4. The Pentium 4 was kind of an aberration, but the core is sufficiently different from the M, and I personally am sufficiently unfamiliar with it that I feel uncomfortable including it in this list. I know about some differences which make it quite a bit different from the M, and I really wouldn't want to predict what the performance of software would be without studying the core more carefully than I have. I'd have to sit down with it for a day to get used to it. However, the Pro 2 and 3 have very similar performance. The M has slightly different performance from the 3, and I feel just fine talking about those together. One of the wonderful things about these chips is that I was whimpering a few minutes ago about the 53-bit precision here. It would be so nice if we had 64 bits of precision. And on the Pentium, you do. These CPUs have floating point arithmetic, which is the fastest way to do arithmetic. Integer multiplication on the Pentiums should be done by floating point multiplications. You will get considerably better performance by doing floating point operations on these chips, also on the Pentium 4 and lots of other CPUs. But these CPUs in particular, you get better performance with floating point than you do with the unmentionable integer multiplication instruction. And those floating point operations don't work just on 64-bit registers with 53 bits of integer inside them. They work on 80-bit registers. These CPUs have 80-bit floating point registers, each of which holds some power of 2 to the dot, 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 times a number between minus 2 to the 64 and 2 to the 64. So they don't have issue number 3. Issue number 3 disappears. And on all these CPUs, it's easy to write software where the time for Poly 1305 is the previous number I mentioned. At some point, I totaled up the multiplications and got 17 multiplications, and I totaled up the additions and got 36 additions. The Poly 1305 main loop on these CPUs, thanks to their extended precision instructions, and I should have written that down, these are called extended precision, as a little warning to the BSD users who might be in the audience, if you're using BSD, you have to do a little bit extra in your software to enable extended precision. If you bump into some weird precision issue and you're not sure what's causing it, it's probably something like that, and come ask me about it. Linux doesn't have this problem. Anyway, the Poly 1305 main loop on these processors uses exactly the 17 floating point multiplications and 36 floating point additions that I mentioned before. Again, counting subtractions as additions. That's quite a lot less than 34 floating point multiplications and 68 floating point additions. Issue number 3 is a big one. Having to split your integers into more pieces is not something you want to do. On the other hand, I don't mean to suggest that these CPUs will take 36 or 37 cycles. These CPUs have other slowdowns. The first, the most obvious one, is that these chips have only one floating point unit. These floating point instructions on 80-bit numbers all go through a single unit, which does a single floating point multiplication or addition every cycle. There's only one floating point unit. And that means your number of cycles is greater than or equal to your number of additions as before, and your number of multiplications as before, and also greater than or equal to their sum. The number of cycles is greater than or equal to the total number of floating point operations, which in this case is 53. Which would still be better than 68 if we could achieve it, but there's another problem, another big problem, and then some little problems. The second big problem is that there's only 8 floating point registers. And that's a really, really small number of floating point registers. When you actually look at the software for doing this type of computation, try writing it yourself, then you see that it's convenient to have 32. It's maybe okay to have 20 or so. 15, okay, maybe, but 8 is just tiny. It's really hard to get yourself doing anything in just 8 floating point registers. Now, there is some compensation for the small number of registers, which is that these CPUs are out of order. This effect is reduced. The damage is reduced by these CPUs, unlike the UltraSpark, being out of order. They start instructions out of order. The UltraSpark, the last bottleneck we ran into last time, was that the UltraSpark starts, say, a load instruction only after the previous multiplication instruction is finished. And to work around that, we had to separate load instructions from the multiplications. You have to load and then do some other stuff and then do the multiplication using the load. And during those extra cycles, you're using a register for the result of that load. With an out-of-order CPU, you don't have to use that register for that amount of time. If you actually sit down, and I'm certainly not going to describe the instruction set today, but if you sit down and look at exactly what the instructions are here, then you see that the out-of-order performance lets you get away with considerably fewer registers. But it's still a serious problem. There are still many slowdowns, and it's very difficult to fit slow, D-O-W-N-S, many slowdowns. It's really hard to fit your computation into 8 floating point registers. You end up doing a lot of loads and stores, and avoiding the load latency and the store latency is really tricky. It's hard to avoid the load latency in particular. I'm sorry? The effect is, if you write, okay, you have to fit your computations into registers. And all your inputs and outputs have to be in registers. Actually, there's another compensating point here, which is that these CPUs can load and operate on the result of the load without using an intermediate register. But most of your results have to be in registers. Any output of arithmetic has to be saved in a register. If you only have 8 storage locations, 8 registers on your chip, then once you've used them all for results of computations and you want to compute something else, you have to save one of those 8 results somewhere. And these computations involve naturally many more than 8 results active at the same time, more than 8 numbers you have to remember. So you have to store one of them, copy it to memory, and then once you've copied it to memory, you have a register-free storage location which you can use for another computation. But copying something to memory and then copying it back, loading it when you need it again, takes time. And that's what the slowdown is. Now, the effect is that having a small number of floating point registers, small number of registers generally, a small amount of storage really constrains how many computations you can be keeping active at once. Means you have to wait to copy your data somewhere else and copy it back. That's the bad effect. That effect is reduced by the out-of-order nature of the CPUs, but even though it's reduced, it's still a serious problem. again, I'm certainly not going to get into the details of what's going on here today. I just wanted to do the bottom line, which is that the main loop, because of these effects, there's a positive, very positive effect of these CPUs have huge multipliers, 64 by 64 bit instead of 53 by 53, bigger floating point numbers, bigger, more precise, better Intel. Well, AMD also has this same instruction set. Anyway, that's a good thing. And then there's some bad things, like only one floating point unit, that's the easy thing to understand, and then trickier effects of register pressure and, on the other hand, out-of-order execution, somewhat compensating for that. The bottom line is that we can't get down to the 53 cycles, as far as I know. The main loop in the Poly 1305 PPRO software takes 61 cycles on the Pentium M, which is noticeably bigger than 53, but it's in the same ballpark. If you're not worried about 15% differences, then okay, it's pretty close to the best conceivable, not too much worry. There's more of a gap on the Pentium 3, 73 Pentium cycles, more cycles than the UltraSpark, just because of latency delays, which, again, are tricky to analyze. I don't want to suggest this is an easy issue to understand. The 73 is not something obvious. The 61 is also not something obvious. And for me, the Pentium 3 in particular is one of the hardest CPUs to understand the performance of. The Athlon, for example, is much simpler to get a handle on. There's lots of pieces of software where I can't explain even within 10% what the performance is. But, okay, it's something somewhat larger than 53, the obvious bottleneck, and the reason for that are some complicated latency effects, which all boil down to there's not very many floating point registers. So you have to be copying back and forth to memory. All right. I wanted to finish the Blackboard part and go on to the computer part. The last things that I wanted to say on the Blackboard were, how do you actually get this kind of software written? Looks like we have some safe region in the bottom middle here. So when you actually want to write this type of software, and then I'll show you on the computer the relevant tools, start by getting it right. So first, write some software that works. I think people often get into trouble trying to produce these kinds of results by saying, okay, I'm going to jump into assembly language immediately and figure out the perfect order of instructions immediately, and they just give up without ever getting anything working. So write some software that breaks your numbers into floating point numbers and multiplies those, for example, and start throwing in mod p's and whatever other operations your function demands. Make a 4 floating point register 130-bit addition, for example, which is just adding floating point registers together, 4 of them together with another 4, and then multiplication, which is, of course, more complicated, etc. There's carrying. Build up the functions that you need, all of which you can do in C. I usually do this in C. And then you start making it fast. Once you have the right number of floating point multiplications, floating point additions, and then all sorts of functions that are operating on your chunks of numbers, then you get rid of the function overhead. Rewrite in an assembly language, which I'm going to point to in particular, CASM. You can use various assembly languages, but CASM is designed for this type of computation, this type being fast computation. Rewrite the software in assembly language, merge the functions, to eliminate the function call overhead, the time for a function call, the cycles for function calls. And then finally, you have one big function, which is doing your complete computation. Like if you look at Poly 1305, it doesn't have any function calls inside it. It's just one function that has one big loop. And then reorganize the instructions, reorder the instructions to eliminate any latency bottlenecks that you might encounter, which for something like the Pentium 3 is awfully hard to do, but reorder the instructions to save time. Look at the lower bounds at every moment and say, how many floating point operations do there have to be? How many cycles is the floating point unit spending? And then, okay, start timing the function at this point and say, what can we do to get the actual time for the function down to the number of cycles that the units have to be busy? I have a picture that I like to draw, and then I'll wash my hands because there will be enough time on the computer to justify it. I have a picture I like to draw of the CPU time, which is everything I've been talking about so far. That's on the vertical axis. And then much longer axis, and I would say a more important axis, what's studied in software engineering is the programmer time. It's certainly satisfying as a mathematician to say there exists an algorithm, there exists a sequence of instructions that performs this computation in time, blah, blah, blah. But in my applied role as an applied cryptographer, I would like to actually have the sequence of instructions that does the computation in time, blah, blah, blah. And in order to produce that without spending a huge amount of my time, I find it really important to minimize the programmer time. Now, within this picture, I would say very frequently people are up here in the top left. This is your typical software, which if you feed it to an optimizing compiler, and there's a whole lot of dots around here. This is tons and tons of pieces of software, a huge market for this kind of large CPU time software. If you feed it to an optimizing, i.e. improving compiler, then maybe it gets faster, although I think we saw an example where something got slightly slower yesterday, but hopefully the compiler will typically speed up the software here. So this is the effect of typical software after you've fed it through an optimizing compiler. I'll put optimizing in quotes. And that's certainly a valuable improvement. It's towards the bottom left where we'd like to be of no programmer time and no CPU time. But if you want high speed, let me just draw a line on this diagram and say this is the line of high speed where most software just never reaches it. And most optimizing compilers aren't even thinking about this kind of line. They just want to improve the speed somewhat and have no hope of getting to high speed. Traditionally, there's been a lot of programmer time put into the occasional functions which run at high speed, which are, say, over here. This is traditional. I'll again put optimized in quotes. Assembly language software. And those of you who've written assembly language software in a traditional assembly language know that it's a royal pain. You have to sit there allocating registers by hand, for example. You have to say, okay, this integer is going to be in %EBX, and then some other integer can't be in EBX until I'm done with this EBX, and when is that going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. All sorts of bugs, all sorts of software rewrites. Every time you reshuffle your operations, you have to rethink your register allocation. Royal pain to write software here. Plus, the notation for traditional assembly languages, as I've given a few examples of, is horrendous. Now, CASM, depending how optimistic I feel about its prospects, is somewhere along this high-speed line. Same goal of producing high-speed software, but hopefully with a lot less programmer time. So this is CASM-assisted software. With that advertisement, I will pop up the web, except, oops, I realize the computer's not even online yet. Trouble, give me just a moment here. Give me 30 seconds to wash my hands and give me one more minute to get the computer online. Okay, I'm back, and now it's the computer's turn. Wake up, computer, talk to the network, please. In the meantime, while I'm getting the computer to do something, are there questions about the Pentium or the big picture of writing optimized software or life, universe, and everything, which I could usefully answer? Yeah? What features does Chasm have? Well, for example, it has register allocation. So you don't have to bother saying this is in %05 and this is in %EBX. This is something which most assemblers don't have. Chasm has a sane notation. Chasm also has something that's not being provided yet, but Chasm has its own cycle simulator. So you can look at the results and say, ah, here is where the time is going. Maybe not perfectly accurate simulators, but a lot better than nothing. And Chasm has a few other tools which I won't advertise because there's no hope that I'll get them ready for everybody to look at during the course time, but yeah, in case the blatant promotion did not make that clear, I wrote Chasm. Well, okay, I'm allowed to toot my own horn here because I have the current cryptographic speed records for a variety of functions, all of which I obtained with the help of Chasm, which has been evolving over time, and has finally gotten to the point where early this morning I decided, okay, it's reasonable now. I can put it on the web and expose it to you for your course project. Unfortunately, my computer is still sitting here trying to obtain a network connection and perhaps never succeeding. Try the cable. Ah, yes. Ooh, it just got a network connection. Perfect timing. Thank you, Murphy. So now, hopefully, we're online. And now we get to, actually, let's just restart Firefox, just in case it remembers the old non-existent resolver, and go to the course webpage, which now has, down at the bottom, after what I had before, it has a link to a big gray box. It has some comments about Chasm, the tarball, which you can download, some instructions later on. What you see down here is exactly what you have to type, and then a sample program in Chasm, which is a little trickier than the typical Spark Chasm stuff because there's some what are called callee save registers on the x86 architecture, but you can pretty much just copy what's at the top here and then eventually get to the line that I'm pointing to now. Says start a function, add vector, enter add vector. And then there's some variable definitions on the stack. The stack is your temporary variables. Those are in memory. There are some variables named ustack, vstack, wstack, and lenstack. There are also some registers later on named u, v, and w, and len. The ustack, vstack, wstack, and lenstack are declared as inputs. Those are, this is a function add vector, which has inputs of u, v, w, and len. U, v, and w are interpreted later as pointers, and len is an integer, the length of a vector. V and w are vectors of length len, and they're added to form u, which is another vector of length len, which is the output. Here's another register definition of float 80, an 80-bit floating point number called x. And then there's this x86 complication, which you can copy and paste, and then copying from memory into a register is just, same as the C notation would be. There's a little bit of stuff that C can't express, like setting flags without doing a computation is something that it looks a little bit weird here. Len minus zero. This is something where I also have a warning here that the Chasm development version is changing the syntax here for error correction reasons that this syntax turns out, in my experience, to be a little bit error prone, but aside from the change that will happen, the len minus 0 isn't being put anywhere, but it is comparing len to 0. And then there's a go to if len is equal to 0, and then there's the top of a loop and a load and an addition, and you can read all the details online. This is doing adding a floating point number to another floating point number, putting the result somewhere, and then moving along in some arrays. Typical assembly language software, but in a syntax that I hope people can read without the effort required to read typical x86 assembly language. So that's just one example that I had time to put up this morning, and then you can call this addVector.c is just a typical C program that calls that addVector program. If you look on the web page, you can see how to compile all these things together. The other thing that I wanted to emphasize was the CPU cycles. If you want to time your software, the place to look for that, which unfortunately I forgot to put a link to that on the page here, but the things to remember are EBATS, that's the Ecrypt benchmarking project to which you can submit your public key implementations, and CPU cycles. Let's just try a Google search, EBATS CPU cycles. It's either Google is slow, which I doubt, or the Fields Institute is slow. But eventually we will get the top link, hopefully being the EBATS CPU cycles link, which will tell you how to download the CPU cycles software. Question? It does. The current, the what I put up this morning is just for producing x86 code. However, it is very, very easy for me to set up a machine description for a new machine. And in fact, I didn't include it here, but I have enough for the Spark to be doing serious software for the Spark, and in a previous format, which I haven't updated yet, but which won't take me too much time. I should have this all done by a week and a half if anybody's interested. I have the PowerPC, the old Macintosh chips. Is there a particular CPU you're interested in other than? You use PowerPC. Okay, so I will make sure by Monday in a week and a half when the course lectures restart to have the PowerPC stuff available on the webpage along with the x86 stuff. And then, yeah, I've certainly done Chasm-assisted software for the PowerPC, and it'll be no problem to do the to integrate that with the current Chasm release. Google is being really, really slow. I suspect it's the wireless network here. But in any case, if you do a Google search for EBATS, the Ecrypt, sorry? True. But I'm suspecting it's actually the wireless. Oh, yes, we actually have it here, EBATS. And, yeah, it seems to be taking a long time here. So if you go to that EBATS and then look down the left side for CPU cycles, then you can see how to download the CPU cycle software. There's getting into Chasm programming, learning a new language is always something that you should say, okay, it is something to learn, but I've tried to make the language design as easy as possible for a C programmer to learn. Subject to, C doesn't have most of the machine instructions out there, and well, to the extent that things look sensible, like A equals B plus C, it's expressed the same way in the Chasm language as in the C language. To the extent that something is weird and that's just how a machine works, then, well, you'll have to learn how Chasm does it. All right. I still have a few minutes to ask people about course projects, but it looks like there's a question. So what Chasm will produce, you will write a .q file like this, addVector.q. And what happens is, as is explained on the web page here, this .q file gets converted into a .s file, which actually it occurs to me that I have this sitting in this very account. Let me make a larger font size here. How about courier at 16 point? That should be more readable. Okay. Suppose I cd into the Chasm directory, and then I was just playing with somewhere an example of this code, probably the same addVector. Ah, yes, there we go. So addVector.q is the same function that we were just looking at in the Chasm language, and then if you want to compile it together with C, then you have to convert it to normal assembly language, which looks something like this. Let me get rid of the comments there. Oops. Okay, so there is an example of traditional assembly language, which is maybe not too painful to understand, like MOVEL 8% ESP, percent ESI, but to me, I think it's, if you're starting from C, then I think you have a better chance of understanding the .q file. And to produce this .s output, all you do is you run the program, which is produced for you by following the instructions on the web page. You run CASMX86 with input being addVector.q and output being addVector.s. And it finishes, and well, then you can compile it together with, I had this separate addVector.c, which is the test program for this addVector.s. AddVector.s now is the assembly language produced from Q, and C is the C program that tests it, and those are compiled together into AddVector. And then running this AddVector, what it does is generates a random vector of whatever length, I guess length 7 looking at the screen, and then the test program tried generating two of those vectors and then adding them, and then feeding the same vectors to the function and printing out the input and output of the function, which hopefully it's exactly the same thing. I don't know, maybe there was a bug, but it looks like it successfully added the numbers same way in the C code as it did in the assembly language code. By writing something in CASM instead of in C, you give yourself a much easier time getting down to this level of CPU time, producing actual high-speed software instead of low-speed software. And compared to traditional assembly language, I hope, well, in my experience, the whole reason I wrote this was that I found myself using a lot of time to do stuff in traditional assembly languages, and using CASM has saved me quite a bit of time and enabled me to generate a bunch more speed records than I had before. Okay, I did want to ask people about what projects they were thinking of looking at, and if anybody had questions about what projects they might look at, haven't come to any decisions, then I'd be happy to discuss that. I think that would be best as a group discussion with the people who are interested in doing the course projects, because I think this type of implementation work is something that works very naturally with teams. On the other hand, if somebody wants to do something solo, that can also work very well. So if there are more questions that are not about the project, then I'd be happy to address those. Otherwise, if the people who are interested in projects would like to stick around for a few minutes, let's say 5 minutes afterwards, then we can chat about what projects people are looking at. I'm going to be around for next week, but this weekend would be a natural time for anybody who's not doing anything else to get started on actually writing some software. So were there any non-course project-related questions? Okay, in that case, thank you for your attention this week, and I will see the non-project, well, I'll see the project people for a few minutes now and the non-project people in a week and a half, Monday afternoon, starting at 3:30. Thanks. Remind me who the project people were. Show of hands. Okay, so anybody who did want to stick around, I guess, what projects do people want to do? What functions? Rob, you wanted something impractical, right? Okay. Well, Ntrue is notable for having no serious performance problems. Most of the systems are things that will give, for instance, good signing time, good verification time, good this, good that, but say bad key size. They'll have quadratic key size compared to what you're used to. Ntrue, everything looks good. And so doing a fast Ntrue implementation would be something perhaps fun. Thanks to Tanya for the suggestion. There is Ntrue software out there. I'm not aware of any optimized public Ntrue software. I don't know whether the Ntrue company software, there's a company selling Ntrue to people, and I don't know whether their software is something that has been written in assembly language, but in any case, reproducing the results or getting better results with published software is a step forward. There are certainly other possibilities, but Ntrue is, I like Tanya's suggestion of Ntrue as a system which is, well, it's a post-quantum system. Nobody has better attacks with quantum computers, and it's a very attractive encryption system in that it doesn't have any performance problems. I mean, the exact performance is something you can look at, but it doesn't have anything that scares people like a, say, 50,000 byte public key or some other feature. Like some systems have 10,000 byte signatures, and there are some applications where that's okay, but there are also some applications where that takes a long time. N-true encryption, yeah. N-true signatures, it seems you need very big key sizes to make those secure, and so people are scared of N-true signatures. There was a funny history of people who were proposing N-true signatures, version 1, promptly broken, version 2, promptly broken, version 3, promptly broken, version 4, promptly broken. The current version was only sort of broken. Like if you sign more than a million messages, then somebody can deduce the key. And then they started saying, well, okay, we'll tweak it like this, and then you need like a billion messages before you can figure out the key. And we don't think you should use the key for more than 10,000 messages anyway, and blah, 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 blah. But I'd say at this point, N-true signatures don't have a really good reputation, so it's certainly more fun for people to see N-true encryption software. Having said that, there's no reason that the high-speed cryptographic software people write has to be for the most popular systems, and the current situation is that N-true signatures in their latest form, version 68, or whatever version they're up to at this point, have not been broken yet. So maybe that could be interesting. I guess, yeah, well, the risk is that you start writing the software, and within 2 weeks, they've had the latest version broken again. No, I think the last one's held up for several months now, so it maybe has a good chance. So what other projects were people thinking about looking at?